All right, we're on. It's Liquid Lunch, and welcome to the live portion of today's show. And we're here on thatradio.com. My name's Hugh Riley, and we're here with Mary Kretsch from Talisman Fiber Arts Studio. And Mary, welcome to That Radio.
Thank you.
So the reason you're here is that you've got, I guess, you've got an art show coming up in Toronto.
Correct.
And now it just occurred to me because we got the press release and it was all about photography.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as we were kind of getting ready for talking, we were talking a lot about textile
mm-hmm.
art.
Mm-hmm.
And before we get into that, maybe you just want to give us a little bit of a background on what this show is.
Okay.
And what it's about.
Okay. Well, in my own personal work, I do use a lot of photography. I use a lot of vintage photography because through some inheritances from family members over the years, I've accommodated quite a lot of old photographs from the 1920s, 1930s, farm life in rural Ontario from my father's side. And my mother was very good at documenting her life since she was a little girl in photography as well. So I've got a lot of photographs from her growing up in the Kitchener area. And then the stories between my parents and these photographs, of which a lot of the people in the photographs are no longer remembered or known or who they
mm-hmm.
are, because the documentation of the photograph was there, but never necessarily the documentation of the people in the photograph. And so I've started a few years ago sort of looking at these photographs and making up new stories for these people, giving them identities, because I just thought it was really sad that nobody knew their names or what was in their life. And so that's what's inspired a lot of my artwork is these old photographs, these vintage photographs, and creating creative little, what I call ta-da stories that are sort of start with people telling me a little snippet of something about themselves, and it sort of inspires my imagination, and it's that little snippet sort of ends up into one of my ta-da stories. This particular show stemmed from the Found Identities Project. That's what I'm calling my continuous ongoing project with these photographs.
Sorry, what are you calling it?
I'm calling it the Found Identities Project simply because they're identities that I'm finding in the photographs.
Okay.
With my own stories and my own concepts. And I had been offered this venue space where I'm doing the current workshop, or this current, sorry, exhibition called Secrets to Dream On. And the photograph that we are all being inspired by, there's five of us artists that are doing it. I wrote the sort of best friend story. There are four women, for the people who can't see the photograph in the picture, all in their Sunday best on the bank of a river somewhere in rural Ontario. They're all wearing their wonderful 1920s, 1930s garb. Obviously
mm-hmm.
just came from church, maybe out for the family picnic, who knows. And asked artists to look at a story at the picture, take one of the women who were named, write a story, and explain to me how they would illustrate that through their work, that story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the whole project started.
Okay, so it's not a photography exhibit.
Not exactly, no.
It's inspired by these old photographs.
Correct.
But really it's a fabric art, textile?
Textile art, or mixed media artists who use textile techniques in their work.
Okay. And just to give people, this exhibit's going to be on at the Rustic Cosmo Cafe from...
It starts May 2nd,
yep.
And it will go till July 2nd.
And we're going to give all the details about the about that at the end of the interview. But so I'm just trying to imagine, just to get a taste of it, what fabric art, textile art inspired by photography looks like.
Okay, well, I can start with one of the artists that's involved, two of the artists that are involved in the show are both from Newfoundland. And they both are involved in rug hooking, but both come at rug hooking, the traditional rug hooking technique, in a different aspect. One lady has taken nothing but rug hooking with kind of rag pieces of fabric and created these beautiful silhouettes of all the four women and what she envisions the four women would be looking like through her craft on beach scenes. And the stories sort of reflect that a little bit. The other lady basically uses her rug hooking techniques to create a frame around a beautiful hand-painted piece of fabric that's been stitched and add a few seashells to, and so on and so forth. So
mm-hmm.
that's one way that the work was done. Another one of the artists is very much influenced in this show by the North, and she's done a lot of trips up to the northern parts of the world, the Arctic, the Inuit, Greenland, that sort of thing, and sat with the people and learned their stories and their techniques. So a lot of her work is influenced by that. And two of her pieces are actually books that are going to hang on the wall and you can page through telling her story with that very, very obvious Inuit influence in them. All in fabric, all in cords and stitching and all the rest of it. And then another artist is more of a quilter. She prints and dyes her own fabrics, and her pieces all incorporate beautiful silhouette drawings as well of the ladies as she interpreted them in her pieces.
So these are the same four ladies.
These are the same four ladies. Five different artists writing different stories for each of the four ladies, and taking their art techniques and ideas and illustrating those stories.
Okay. And you also are one of the artists. You're
I am
not
also
just
one of the
artists. A curator.
No.
And we'll get to that story, how you started out as an artist, but then you, as part of your work, you realized you had to get into the curating business.
Right.
And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But what about your work?
My art is surface design collage, is what I kind of qualify it as. And I do use a lot of photography in my work. Do the photography on my own, or I take the old photographs and transfer them onto fabric. So a lot of the times you will actually see that photograph that you're kind of looking at there, possibly, or a piece of it in the actual work. And then I come back in and I stitch with found objects. I really do use a lot of mixed media. I mean, I throw paint in there and paper and whatever inspires me, and it ends up being more of a collage piece than an actual, with lots of symbolism and so on and so forth. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the question you're trying to answer in this exhibit is, are we losing sight of our genetic past?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, because of my own personal relationship with these photographs that are in my collection and that are family, particularly on my father's side, I mean, I'm growing up, I've had a very long-term best friend relationship with my mother. So on her side of the family, I pretty much know what the family history is. On my father's side of the family, there have actually been two books written about the Crutches. Robert Crutch, the Canadian writer, is a distant relative. There's a branch of the family out in the West somewhere. There's 300 of them. I just met somebody over the internet whose last name is Crutch, and she wasn't aware of me, and she's a textile artist from Quebec. So the family
name...
That's
kind of a coincidence.
It is kind of a coincidence. And I've had one of the Newfoundland ladies in my current show, her family's from the Kitchener area, so we've been exchanging little tidbits about growing up in that area as well.
So they moved to Newfoundland from
Kitchener. Yeah, well, she
for
did.
For the opportunity.
Probably. She could be listening to this right
actually,
now.
Actually, you know, she probably... I hear Newfoundland is the best kept secret in the whole country, though, economically many other ways
think,
as well.
Yeah, I think we don't really know what's going on down
no,
there
we
unless
don't.
We go and visit.
And they don't want us to know.
No, they don't, because they don't want us all coming down
they
there
keep,
and enjoying
that's
them.
That's right. They keep telling us they're all moving out to Fort McMurray, but... We know that's just a PR ploy. Okay.
Yeah. So when my father came into the marriage with my mother, he brought these 120-odd negatives with him, and his parents didn't know who they were. Although when you look at some of the pictures when you start, producing them, I can see my grandparents in them as a young couple. But the rest of the aunts and uncles and family friends and stuff that are surrounding them in these your traditional 1920 posed pictures, there's no action shots, they're all like lined up like the wedding pictures of today, and you don't know who they are. There's no one knows who they are. No one's ever been able to tell who they are. The only thing I know for sure is that what my grandmother's maiden name was, my grandfather's, where he came from originally was North Dakota, that he was living in Trout Creek, which is north of Algonquin Park, while my grandmother was living over in Hanover. How they ever got together, before the 20s as far as courting and stuff like that, don't know. But the whole idea of trying to figure out who these people are, who I will never probably ever really, really know unless they did something special and it was archived in some way, made me feel kind of, sad, and that I think a lot of us are losing sight of what our family history is. I think of my generation has already lost. The next generation coming behind me, I'm trying to give them a little bit of something. But my mom just passed away in January, and she was the last of the matriarchs for that side of my family.
Mm-hmm.
And if it wasn't for her documentation and her journaling and all the rest of it, it would all be lost. That information would be lost. I don't have any children, so who am I going to hand it down to?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's grandchildren and great-grandchildren coming up in the next generations. And I think slowly and But surely what happened 100 years ago in families, that information is just disappearing, that we are losing sight of that with all the technology. And, you know, they say the technology is bringing us closer together, but I think it's pushing us farther and farther apart.
Certainly having some effect. Mm-hmm. Maybe we won't really know what that is until it's too late.
Well, you know.
Okay. All right. So let's talk a bit about your work as an artist, mm-hmm. because you mentioned that I guess that's your life's work is being a fabric artist or a textile artist.
It is now. Yeah. I've actually been artistically inclined, creatively inclined, and certainly inspired by all kinds of art for a very long time. I've only actually attempted to be an artist full-time over the last 3 years. Before that, I did the practical thing. You know, your parents push you in the practical direction. So for many, many years, I was in the information technology industry and living out of a suitcase and traveling all over the world doing my thing as an independent consultant. And very successful at it. And in my early years, it was fun and exciting to see new places and try new foods and restaurants. But as I got older, my team kept staying the same age, or basically getting younger. And eventually, I just woke up one day and I said, I can't do this kind of traveling anymore. It's kind of killing my creative spirit. And I always traveled with needle and thread, because before September 11th, I could actually sew and stitch on an airplane or in an airport without any problems. Now it's considered a weapon.
Yeah.
So I kind of took the edge off my traveling and waiting for delayed flights and so on and so forth, you know. So I got a rude awakening of my creative spirit when I was doing a project in Boulder, Colorado, back in about 2001. And I went on one of those studio tours, and I was just blown away with what some of the textile artists were doing. I mean, I had never seen some of the art that was being created by some of these textile artists down there here in Canada. I mean, I'm sure it was happening, but somehow, with me being on the road all the time, it just never occurred to me that you could do those kinds of things, that you could take something you would weave on a loom, cut it up, and reconfigure it into something that was so unusually abstract but still beautiful. I just, mm-hmm. you know, no one ever gave me permission to take something I'd sewn or created on a sewing machine and manipulate it that way. So I kind of fell in love with this concept of cutting and slashing and taking something that was really, really beautiful to begin with and turning it into something even more beautiful and different. So that's what I decided to get off the road, and I've been working at trying to find my way through a doorway to sell my art and work as an artist or work in the arts. It doesn't mm-hmm. even have to be as an artist. And
well, and as you've admitted, part of your journey to become a fine artist in the medium of textile and fabric, you've felt a need to get into the curating as well. And I guess obviously the reason is, as you said, you were having difficulty getting it out there. So, like so many of us, you know, we have to do it ourselves.
Right, exactly. I think that that's the only way a lot of artists are going to make it, is to find a different segue into getting themselves seen and noticed.
You had to create the venues where your own work and the work of others.
Yeah, exactly. Could get seen. You know, you can't work alone as a solo artist. I know that's a big thing for a lot of artists. They want to be alone. But the problem is that is a lot of hard work. I did it once for myself, and it can take you 8 to 9 months to create enough pieces to fill even a small gallery wall. There's so many ways to represent yourself in the arts world now in Toronto that, you know, who knew was there, probably wasn't even there 5-10 years ago. And, you know, you can rent space and blow up some money that way, and no one will come because you put all your energy into renting the space and making your pieces, and there's no time left or energy left to do the marketing.
Yeah, now you're in the real estate business.
That's right, you're in the real estate business. And then there's you rent a gallery, and you go to, say, like some place like maybe the Lennox Contemporary Gallery, which is over on Ossington and Queen West area. Now you can rent that space as an artist or a group of artists.
Sorry, what's it called?
It's called the Lennox Contemporary. There's a lot of them over on Queen West you can actually rent the space as an artist or a group of artists and then put on a show. But you still have to do everything there is to do for that show, you know, sit it, hang it, all the rest. And that's a lot of work. So curating seemed to be after doing my first show, seemed to be a way to look into getting into the arts and bringing my art form and other people's art forms that work with in my medium kind of out and being seen. I mean, we don't seem to have any venues that we can go to. Mm-hmm. Textile artists have traditionally been picked up by galleries that are strictly for the craft kind of category of artwork, like the Guild Shop up at Yorkville, which is part of the Ontario Crafts Council organization. Mm-hmm. Or we end up getting opportunities to be seen in government buildings like City Hall foyers or public libraries, and that's all very nice, but you can't sell because they have rules about that kind of thing. And nobody really goes to a city hall to see a piece of art, really. I mean, it's nice if they get caught and stopped, but...
I got to say, every time I'm in city hall, though, there's a lot of great artwork.
There is a lot of great artwork.
You just stop and just look around you. There's tons of stuff, and it's all seems to be very Toronto. You get a sense of the history of the city as well.
Yeah, and it's very inexpensive to produce a show that way. Yeah. But, you know, if you really want to move into that commercial realm, which is what I'm trying to do for myself and any artists that are willing to work with me, and that's the big thing. I want artists that want to work with me, not just sit on my shoulder and wait for me to make things happen for them. But it's really, really difficult to do that in your traditional sense of things. I mean, if you don't get an agent, there's more money out. And it's just seemed like a natural way for me to segue into finding another way to get myself seen, and along the way hopefully get other artists in this particular realm seen as well.
Okay, so I'm going to just drop it right now, and it's going to be at the Rustic Cosmo Cafe, 1278 Queen West, from May the 3rd to May... when?
To July 2nd.
July 2nd. Mm-hmm. Okay, so basically for most of May.
Most of May and July. Yeah. So that's one of the
or
nice things.
June. May and June.
May and June.
2 months.
Yeah. That's one of the nice things about alternative venues like that is from an exposure point of view, you do get more time with the galleries. Most traditional contemporary galleries, you're lucky if you get 2 weeks.
And you get people coming in for the coffee.
Exactly.
And they might fall in love with the art.
Exactly. So. I mean, buying art is an emotional purchase. And I know myself, over the years of buying a piece of art, I'll go back to a gallery two or three times before I actually finally make that decision. I want to feel like I'm living with it a little bit, even if it is in a gallery setting. Whereas these alternative venues like cafes and sandwich shops, it's like you sit down, you have a cup of coffee. If you're a regular, you come back, you see it for three or four times during the time that it's there, and you're actually living with it and get a sense of whether it's going to fit on your wall or not at your mm-hmm. own home. You know, mm-hmm. you start to fall in love with it before you actually make the purchase. So it's kind of nice.
Okay. Well, I want to talk a bit about, because you're on a bit of a mission, it seems, to take fabric art from where it resides kind of in the craft category and bring it more into the fine art category.
Yep.
And can you tell me a little bit about that?
It's kind of hard to. I guess I get on my soapbox a little bit on this topic because
this is a good time. This is a soapbox right
this
here.
This is a soapbox.
So get on
yeah.
your soapbox and tell us all about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a passionate thing with me. It's a debate I have a lot with a lot of different types of artists because I love all kinds of art, whether it's abstract sculpture, paint, you know, whatever. And the thing that really excites me about textile art right now is that I'm seeing a lot of artists sort of grab a hold of textile art in funny ways. Like there are photographers out there right now, you know, Contact's just coming up next week it starts, which is the big huge, you know, Toronto-wide photography festival. Every gallery in town will have photography of some sort in it, and even photographers are looking for new ways to get their black and whites seen. And so there's photographers out there actually painstakingly stitching through the photographic paper and putting a little bit of colored embroidery on their photographs, believe it or not.
Just to make the cut?
I don't know about to make the cut, but just to make it a little more interesting. So, you know, there are a lot of different art mediums out there looking at textiles as or textile techniques as a way of enhancing their work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, unfortunately, there has been this wall between what is fine art, and now they've got the word fine craft too. It's not even craft anymore. It's fine art versus fine craft. And for me, it's all art. Mm-hmm. One way or another, it's all art. And then there's different definitions about what craft is. One group of people will tell me that their definition of craft is, if it's usable, it's craft. Well, a painting can be usable. It's usable in home decor. It's not a practical use, but it's still a usable thing, you know? So I just don't like this brick wall. I think if an artist is an artist is an artist, basically, you know, like in textile art is getting a, its time has come, in my opinion, to break down that wall or break through it a little bit and get on the other side so that we're viewed as visual artists as well as fine crafters.
It's interesting because you mentioned about, painting can be used, its purpose is to be used for home decor.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when we tend to think of paintings, you know, most people, you know, buy paintings to hang on the walls
mm-hmm.
in their home, or businesses will buy fine art to hang on their walls in, but there's some quote fine art unquote that seems only suitable for art galleries, you know, like no.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just imagining some of the constructions that I've seen in galleries around town. That
you're talking about installation style.
Installations.
Art.
And yeah, of course, I mean, you can't have that in your house.
No.
Right?
No.
and so is that, you know, that almost makes you think, well, gee, what then is the purpose of this kind of fine art? Is it only suitable for, I don't know, what is the purpose of it?
Of installation art?
Well, I'm sort of rhetorical question,
yeah.
But
well, I think, you know, and it's funny you mentioned that style of art, because a lot of textile artists that I have been following for years are very big on installation type art. I don't know if you're familiar with Judy Chicago and the Dinner Party, which was from the 70s. I mean, they just finally found a permanent home for it. It was here in Toronto at the AGO back in late 70s, early 80s.
I don't think I'm familiar with it.
Okay,
so.
Well, Judy Chicago basically got a whole bunch of artists together, and they were ceramists and textile artists and stitchers and all the rest of it. And she created this big triangular installation piece, dinner table, and all the different artists contributed to different place settings, and it was very feminist, involved political of the times. And it was huge. It's still huge. It took up a huge room, you know, and that's a way a lot of textile artists, since her and other artists of her generation, have followed. It's like, that's the way a textile artist kind of gets to be seen. That's
mm-hmm.
what installation is. Let's mm-hmm. shock, mm-hmm. let's make a statement, let's hope somebody picks it up, let's hope the press picks it up, let's hope we get some frontline coverage and all the rest of it. But you're right, where does it go from there? It's certainly interesting to go and visit and look at and get involved with. But it's inaccessible as far as taking you art as the artist of that particular installation to the next level that you want to be at, which is paying the bills, selling something that you can pay the bills with.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay. Well, listen, this is a real jumping off point to a whole discussion about art in general.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you're game for carrying on with that.
I can wander on as long as you want, but... Whatever you want.
I'd hardly call it wandering. But let's take a musical break and we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more art with Mary Kretsch from Talisman Fiber Arts and about your upcoming show at the Rest of Cosmos. We'll be right back after this musical break with Mary Kretsch here on Liquid Lunch.
Yeah. didn't need anyone but me. I sincerely thought I was so complete. Look how wrong you can be. The women I've known, I wouldn't let tie my shoe. They wouldn't give you the time of day. But the slit-eyed lady knocked me off my feet. God, I was glad I found you. And if there were words I could tell to you, to help you on the way down the road, I couldn't quote you no Dickens, Shelley O'Keefe.
Back here on Liquid Lunch, we're speaking with Mary Kretsch, who's from Talisman Fiber Arts Studios, with the art show Secrets to Dream On, which is at the Rustic Cosmo Cafe in May and June. So now they first met in a one-room schoolhouse. None of them knew the extent or importance this meeting would bear on each of their lives. They were only 5 years old, excited about starting school, terrified about being away from home, even for a few hours. But when introduced to recess on that first day, the adventure of lifelong friendships began. They shared everything. Or did they? The friendships were strong and forever. But as each transitioned from girl to young lady to woman, they all saved one or two secrets for themselves. Didn't they?
Secrets to dream on.
Okay, what were some of these secrets?
Some of the secrets, well, I could share one with mine. One of my secrets is the first kiss. I mean, that's a standard story probably in every person's life, not just young ladies. But so that's one of my little stories. Another story I had created for one of the ladies, and her name is Marjorie. She was introduced to Pen Pal from South Africa. And so her secret dream was to someday travel to South Africa. And I have another story about the lady I've called Beth. She's the one in the picture that has the very flamboyant kind of flapper outfit on. And she...
They all look the same to me.
Yeah, those sepia pictures do. You know? But her story is that she discovered or saw the red shoes, which is a dance term. You know, if you become a dancer at some point in time, you see the red shoes. It's just a term. Then you have to be a dancer. And she saw some little boy tap dancing for pennies on the street one day in Toronto and decided that's what she had to do. And little things like that. They're just like, I call them my ta-da, my stories, I call it ta-da stories, because they sort of have, they're less than 500 words. Almost every one of my pieces of art, whether it's this show or anything else I'm doing, mostly include a story to go along with it. And the reason they're ta-das is because they start out and kind of grab your attention, and then before you know it, you're getting the rip shot at the end, and it's all over.
Okay. So, and these stories go, is this a complete story, the one I just read,
That's
by the way?
That's a complete story.
And that goes with one of the pieces in the show.
That goes with the actual main photograph, the one that inspired the whole show.
The one that we can see, but our listeners see right now, with the flappers.
Yeah, the four 1920s ladies in their best Sunday bests.
Yeah. What river do you think that is? That's somewhere in the Kitchen area?
I would think, yeah, probably Hanover, up in that area.
Way up. That's quite a bit north of Kitchener.
Yeah, my parents grew up in Kitchener, and my grandparents came in off the farm. Well, actually, both sides of the family came in off the farms and into town, and that's usually that's when basically that relationship sort of got severed. I mean, it wasn't that easy to go and visit families with, you know, way out there when you were living in town where the work was. You know, it's a story of a historical story that happens over and over again in families.
Where was the farm?
The Hanover one, I don't know for sure. I have never actually been to Hanover.
You've never been to Hanover?
I've never been to Hanover. But the farm from my mother's side was in Gad's Hill, which is also where she got to go to a one-room schoolhouse to visit once in a while when she visited the farm as a little girl. So that's Gad's Hill is somewhere between Kitchener and Stratford in one of those farming communities there.
Okay. All right. I may have actually been there once. Is there a little pub?
Probably. There's a pub everywhere, isn't there?
I noticed there was a pub in every little town around Kitchener.
Yeah.
I once was in it was like a road rally.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a pub rally. So the navigator had to drink at every little pub in every little town.
That's really hard.
It's hard. Yeah. I was the navigator, I think. Maybe I wasn't. Maybe we changed halfway through. Okay, let's not talk about that.
We digress.
We digress. Okay. So, well, listen, while the music was on there, mm-hmm. we were talking about a lot of, I mean, it's funny when the mics are off, you know, you just start talking and it just flows. But you were talking about touching on the history of fabric art mm-hmm. and about political cloths that I guess part of the history. And maybe you just want to touch a little bit about that.
Yeah, textiles have been a key part of history for thousands of years. So it's not just about the stitching and the decorative work that we've done over the years. Yes, there are political cloths from different nations over the years. Russia, you know, back during their revolution, printed up political cloth. Even during the Olympics, you know, in the 30s and 40s, they did political cloths representing the Olympic events that their rowers or whatever were in. Africa in particular, a lot of the countries and nations there, as new politicians come into play, political cloths representing that particular politician and their party are printed up for ceremonial purposes and so on and so forth, and that's still happening today. Textiles have been currency. I mean, even as far back as Marco Polo going to the East, the Silk Road to China, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it's not anything new. I mean, you even mentioned before we started about had I seen any of the war Afghanistan rugs that are being, you know, woven now. I mean, Afghanistan was very big on rugs. That's their really huge textile industry. And no, I haven't seen any of those yet, but there's a whole idea of political textiles right there, even mm-hmm. in modern times. Mm-hmm. So textiles continue to play a huge role in our history. And one of the things, even suffragetting, if you go back to women getting the vote, the whole thing about women getting the vote was men thought we would lose our opportunity to take care of them and cook their meals and clean their houses, and we would lose our femininity. And they would actually embroider all their banners and use the finest of silks and fabrics to embroider their banners, put on their Sunday best, and do their marches using textile banners that they had created to show as part of their thing. We just want to vote. We just want to have a say in how this country is run, but we're not going to lose our femininity over it.
Mm-hmm.
So little statements like that have been documented.
And there's this whole phenomenon of quilting.
Quilting.
As a, I'm not sure what it is, but like creating these, getting hundreds of thousands of people to work together to create a quilt to make some kind of a political statement.
Community quilts are still a big thing all over the world. They've had their history has kind of gone back and forth. There's been a lot of changes in quilting. There's still the traditional quilts of organizations or cultures like the Mennonites and so on and so forth. There's still quilting bees in small communities in different parts of the world. There are art quilts now that are unbelievable, where you know, you have to get really, really close to it to even realize it's fabric and stitching, because it's so beautifully hand-painted. The fabric is actually hand-painted and then put pieced back together, and you're looking at a beautiful maiden on a boat somewhere in a river, but standing back, it looks like a beautiful oil painting or a watercolor on a wall. You know, it's unbelievable what some of the quilting artists are doing these days. Even from the point of view of what was known as crazy quilting, what was basically people using textiles and fabric, like the old days of pioneers. I mean, there wasn't a lot of money to replace clothing, so the clothing would be worn until it was threadbare, and then they would save the pieces that weren't threadbare and turn them into crazy quilts. That's what crazy quilt exists. It's the little patches of old pieces of clothing put together, and so that piece of clothing got one more chance at life being a blanket.
Gee, I thought crazy quilt was some sort of arch villain in some sort of anti-superhero.
It could be, but, I guess.
Okay. All right. So talking about textile art as fine art, I guess people are going to have the opportunity to actually, purchase one of these pieces that are going to be on display at the Rustic Cosmo and then hang it in their home if they like it and appreciate it as a piece of fine art. But I guess you've been now an artist. You changed your career a few years ago. You're now in this full time as an artist and a curator, almost out of necessity by the sounds of it. But where do you think, what's the situation with fine art today? There seems to be a lot of artists, and I've heard complaints from people in the art business about people in Ontario and in Canada not necessarily having the kind of level of appreciation for fine arts that people in some other countries and cultures might have, because we're kind of one of the last countries to emerge from our kind of rural, practical farming, resource-based living into a higher type of more evolved cultural society. What's your take on that? Is there what I'm really getting at is we have a lot of artists now here in Canada. And do we have the demand for art that can support the numbers of people who are on the career path of being artists, visual artists, other kinds of artists?
Really hard question to answer, because you're right. We have, particularly in the last, I would say, 10 years, really been overflown with artists coming out and trying to make a living for themselves. And I admit the support from Canadians is not there, not only from the consumer themselves, but also from governments, taking away a lot of the opportunities that would have supported the arts one way or another financially or whatever.
And the argument could be made and will be made by some that why do we need the government to support artists?
Well, we shouldn't have to have the government.
If there's a demand, shouldn't there be enough money, private sector money, available.
And there's the rub. There's another whole, soapbox topic we could get into about the granting system for artists. I mean, it seems to me that grants are given to the artists that have already kind of made it for themselves, and the ones that could use a little boost to get started aren't given a second look type of thing. But that's another whole half hour type of thing. But you're right. I don't think the Canada's marketplace is where it should be for all the arts, not just visual arts, but all the arts. I think we could really use a little bit more support. I think from my medium, it's purely a lack of education to the investor that what me and artists like me do is an art form worth investing in. Mm-hmm. I think there's another word, do you buy art for the investment value of it,
or because you like it,
and I think you should buy it because you absolutely love it, and the fact if it gains in value, great. If it doesn't, then so what, as long as you enjoy it. I mean, if you're going to buy a piece of art, make sure you want to live with it for the rest of your life. It's got to grab you, because it's not like you could just, you can put it in the closet if you don't like it after a while, but I mean, it's not like you're going to buy a, you're not going to buy a Picasso today at any price because it's just not it's just non-existent. Am I going to be a Picasso? Well, gee, that's a really like really nice dream. But I'd like to live to be a Picasso and enjoy what he had, mm-hmm. as opposed to waiting till I die and something, and all of a sudden my work goes up. I mean, there's a, you know.
Picasso was one of the lucky ones. He got fame in his own lifetime, yeah. and did very well for himself.
Yeah, he did.
So many of the great artists that we appreciate today had miserable lives.
Of course they did. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there too much art?
I think there's too much of some art, yeah. I also feel, this is just personal, I'm not knocking any artist out there. You know, like, go for whatever you want.
I want to get some names, though. Let's dig up the dirt here.
Well, I can't give you names. That wouldn't be very fair. Now, I find that, yes, there is a lot of art out there that, in my opinion, isn't worth hanging on the walls and it's getting hung on. But that's not to say it's not good art to somebody.
Can you tell me what, I mean, not to name names, but what kind of art? What are you talking about?
I think a lot of the abstract paintings that are out there are a bit ridiculous. I think a lot of collage art, you know, where people are just... cutting things out of magazines and slapping them on a piece of canvas and putting a dab of paint here and there is not even well thought out. And I love collage because I do it myself. I think, there's just way too much abstract art out there that you hang on the walls. It doesn't make any sense. Lots of blasts of color, but I don't get a lot of it.
Yeah,
and
okay.
I like abstract.
Should we take these paintings and burn them?
No.
Just to make a point?
No.
Get rid of some of this bad art?
I like that. The chicken
that
legs
one.
Over there.
You're looking at that one over there. Okay, well, I'll tell you, I have my own...
tastes.
Mary's looking at a piece that we have here in the studio. It's called President's Choice. It's one of my prized possessions. I have my entirely own way of collecting art.
And that's fine. And that's the way it should be. That's why we shouldn't burn anybody's art. Because you burn on some person's art and there goes somebody's perfect personal collection. You know what I mean? It's a personal
taste
thing.
But think of it. It would raise the value of the art that doesn't get burned.
Well, yeah, I suppose. I mean, that's like saying... last summer there was an exhibit on at the Textile Museum of Canada, which is just around the corner from you here. Called A Beautiful Something. Anyways, it was all, this artist had taken a very abstract concept for a very short period of time in Victorian society, where they were very enthralled with natural science, and a part of natural science is bugs. And so they were using bugs and butterflies and, you know, reptiles and stuff as in repeated patterns on wallpapers and so on and so forth in their homes as decor. And so she blew that out of the water and created her own sort of wallpaper with bugs, real bugs that had been dried and, you know, preserved and all the rest of it. Big, big, beautiful, bugs from different parts of the world, like South Africa, you know, whatever. And it was really, really quite pretty, but it was still bugs on the wall to me. Now, mm-hmm. is that considered art or is that, is it textile? It's a good exercise in repeated pattern and it's a really good way of blowing a little piece of history out of the water. Got a lot of press all over North America, but is it textile? Is it art? You know, it just raises a whole lot of questions, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, do we chastise that artist for doing that? No, because she did a good thing. She got people to question. She got people to come out to a museum that hardly anybody ever, well, I shouldn't say hardly anybody ever goes to, but if you have a textile interest, you go. But they brought a lot of people in that necessarily wouldn't have gone in if it hadn't been for this concept, you know? So.
Right.
Do you burn paintings? No. Do you chastise a painter for doing what he or she is doing? I don't think so.
Well,
you know, we all have to find our own way.
It's funny. It's. I mean, there is a line somewhere. I mean, I'm thinking of, for example, the. It's been a few exhibits that have generated a lot of controversy. The meat dress of a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Do you recall that one?
Yeah.
I forget the name of the artist, yeah. but that was pretty controversial.
I'm not big on anything gory. It's the best word I can use to describe it. I mean, I understand political statements. I have some political statements of my own to make, you know. But
okay, make one right now.
I can?
Yeah.
Oh, now I'm on the spot.
Come on.
I don't know which one I want to make.
Make your political statement. just pick one.
Pick one. Hmm.
Your most controversial one.
I don't have anything
Go
controversial.
Ahead.
I'm pretty milquetoast. Pretty milquetoast on that part.
No, seriously. Make one political statement right now.
Okay. I think Canada needs to get out of Afghanistan. I don't think we should have been there in the first place. That's my political statement.
All right. Okay. Well, I think that's a sentiment shared by an awful lot of Canadians.
Yeah. I know. And like, can you do that in art? No. But, well, maybe I could. I just think the fact that they opened up a Tim Hortons over there was basically saying they ain't coming out for a while.
Yeah, because really, it's hard to imagine Canadians being anywhere in the world without access to Tim Hortons.
Yeah,
for very
sad.
Long. It's pretty sad, but I'll tell you, if I were a soldier over in Afghanistan, I'd be mighty appreciative. I wonder if they have the breakfast sandwich available over there.
Oh, yeah, those are good.
Are they?
Oh, yeah. Have you had one yet?
I have.
Oh, my God.
I'm not a fan.
No?
No.
I like them.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
I find that there's just no synergy happening with that breakfast sandwich.
Well, it's better than a McMuffin.
I disagree. I'll take the McMuffin.
Now we'll have a political conversation. But
yeah,
we'll choose the
now we're
breakfast.
Getting down to the nitty gritty. Finally. No, I just find the... well, let's not talk too much about that. But I'll take a McMuffin over
Tim
Hortons
sandwich.
See, now
we could do a whole art thing around that.
Could you?
Sure.
No,
why not?
Really. I mean,
actually,
seriously.
Well, you know, the AGO. Well, maybe you don't know, but the AGO in their archives, it was there for years and years and years. It always ended up in the main hall. She just went in the doors, which I don't know what it's going to look like now with the retro they're doing in there now. But it was from the 70s, and somebody made this giant hamburger with a pickle on top, and it was a big canvas hamburger. You know, it was textile art as far as stuffed. It was giant, huge hamburger sitting in the middle of the hall with a pickle on top.
Mm-hmm.
So. It's art. You can make art out of anything.
Hmm. Okay. I'm at a loss for words right now.
I know. If you ever had a chance to see it, you know, you walk. It's a hamburger. You know.
And of course, food as art. Well, let's not talk about that anymore.
No.
Okay. Well, listen. It's been great to speak with you about this stuff. And I think we've touched on a lot of different areas, not just about your own work, but about textile fabric art in general and fine art, the meaning of art, and all that kind of stuff. And it's really, thanks for coming. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me. That was really nice of you to do that for us. I'm sure that somebody will hear this and, you know, maybe come out to the show. There's a website that they can actually preview the show on.
Let's give that out right now.
Okay, it's www.secretstodreamon.cachelan, and I'll spell that cachelan.com. And if you go to that website, you can see the whole show online and read the stories that go with each of the pieces. And but do not make that your only way of seeing the art, because I find textile art is very three-dimensional, even if it is wall art.
Mm-hmm.
It's also very tactile, so you want to come and touch and see. And
so you can actually touch it.
Of course.
I tell you, every time I go into the gallery and I go up to touch this stuff, somebody's slapping my hand.
That's one of another conversation I had with some of the more veteran type textile artists. They want to give you the white gloves and to wear and everything else like that. And I'm thinking, you know, if you really want your piece to be bought and hanging in a home, you better be used to having sticky fingers and animal hair and whatever else get on it. So, I mean, we can't have our art that precious anymore if we really want people to take a look at it.
Especially not when we're talking about tossing it on the pyre, getting rid of it when there's too much
fire,
of it.
We can put it in front of a fireplace. Little throw, you know.
Okay, so again, the show's on at the Rustic Cosmos Cafe, 1278 Queen West in Toronto. Whereabouts on Queen is
it's
that near?
It's just the other side of the tracks that go over from Dufferin.
So just
west of the Gladstone.
Okay, I guess is that Brock or something?
Brock.
Around Brock?
Yeah.
Okay, and they have a phone number there. I'm going to give it out, 416-532-4748. The exhibition hours are Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., Saturday and Sunday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. You have an opening reception.
Yes, a week this Thursday, the 2nd. I'm sorry, the 3rd.
Thursday, May the 3rd, a week from today.
Yeah.
At 7:30 p.m. And is there free food at that?
We're having desserts and fruit. And
you got to love that.
The place is licensed, so. Yeah.
It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the artists from Newfoundland has actually arranged her vacation time, so she's coming up, so we should have a good hoot. Maybe we'll get some screech going. I don't know.
Screech?
Yeah.
I've never been screeched in, so I find that concept intriguing.
It's a treat.
Okay, well, listen, Mary Kretsch, thanks so much for coming in. And by the way, people can catch out. Do you have a website for your Talisman Studios?
I do. It's actually my personal site is textile_mixedmedia_artist.cashlin.com. It's okay. A long one.
That's a mouthful.
Better easy to call, email me, and then I can send you a link.
You want to give out your email?
Yeah, I'll give out my email. It's talisman-beadworks@simpatico.ca.
All right, that's easy. Okay.
All right.
Mary Kretsch, thanks so much for coming in today, telling us about this. All the best with the show, with your work, and maybe we'll see you next Thursday.
Great.
At the Rustic Cosmo.
Great.
Okay. All right. So that's it for Liquid Lunch here on that radio.